This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice.
I'm really excited to welcome to our podcast, to the Gold Rock podcast, Definitely Uncertain, a very good friend, Michael Bloch. Michael has a long and distinguished career in management consulting. He worked and was a partner at McKinsey for many years. And for anybody who knows anything about the world of global management consulting and strategy, McKinsey is like the number one name in that sphere. And Michael has decided over the last number of years, and obviously we'll hear about that in some more detail, to take all of that experience and knowledge and actually passion to and bring it to Israeli society via working with major organizations and particularly NGOs and philanthropy in order to create a much wider and deeper sense of impact in the work that they do. And I'm hoping that today we will learn something of what Michael is up to and how he's thinking about the current situation in Israel, and in particular, how that reflects on strategic philanthropy. And so I welcome Michael. Very nice to have you. And maybe if you could just start by giving us a few words about Israel impact and the transition that you've made.
With pleasure. So first of all, thank you for having me. You know, I've been a fanatic listener of the podcast, and I'm delighted to be on the other side of the mic. So as you said, you know, I was with McKinsey for 23 years. I started in Switzerland and was in France. The last 13 years, we've been in Israel. I had worked with nonprofits on the side for much of my last 10 years in Israel. I would work every year with one or two nonprofits, help them with their strategy or with their growth. But then, and by the way, these were also the most impactful projects I would do that year. I would often turn back in December and see that next to saving $100 million for this bank or helping that other pharmaco grow, what I had done for a small nonprofit in Israel was actually much more impactful because you touched people and you changed lives, or they changed lives, and we were able to help a bit. So I decided 3 years ago to leave McKinsey and focus all my time on these nonprofits. And after many conversations, you know, I spoke with 150 people. It was COVID times. People were bored at home. They had time for me. So I realized that the biggest way to make an impact would be to work with the philanthropic organizations, the philanthropic foundations that were helping in Israel. There are some massive American foundations, especially with hundreds of millions of dollars, sometimes billions of dollars of capital, led by business leaders who made their money in venture capital, in private equity, and want to spend or invest their philanthropic money the way they've earned it, which is professionally, with strategies, with metrics. And I could help. You know, all of these people had already invested in building significant teams of professionals, but those often came from the nonprofit world, and I could add and bridge between the nonprofit and the business world in interesting ways. So that's what I started to do. And in the last 3 years, together with a team of social entrepreneurs, of ex-consultants, we've helped about 20 organizations. Fascinating work.
So I suppose the right way for us to jump into today's conversation is how do we find you just before Simchat Torah? And, you know, take us through that sort of initial period of, you know, shock that the country was in and professionally we were in. How did that transition come, you know, to your door?
Yeah. So I literally had three projects meant to start on October 8th for new organizations. Of course, everything was frozen, on the night of October 7th. Followed by, like many of us, many days of mixed feelings, panic, anger, frustration, fear, and much energy looking for ways to help. So I started, like many of us, raising some money from friends and family and spending it to help soldiers on the ground, but very quickly realized this was not scalable and, you know, was partly duplicative, not very efficient, and so on. So I looked for bigger initiatives I could join. The first one was I joined with my friends from Maniv Mobility to help build an air bridge to the US and bring thousands of pieces of equipment for civil rescue and civil defense. We raised a few million dollars. That was a way to help at scale. But then very quickly, my clients and other funders in the US came and asked, how can they help? And it was very interesting because many of these foundations have well-established, very fundamental processes for how they make decisions as to who to help, how they help, how much they give. And, they threw everything down the window in a day and changed their approach completely. They moved from monthly or yearly giving cycles to literally weekly cycles where they would spend the beginning of the week deciding where to give. On Thursday, the money would go out the door. And next week, they would look at different grantees. They did much less due diligence. They relied on their networks to hear of the needs and to hear about quality organizations which had expertise and were on the ground. And they worked based on trust. So it was very, very, very incredible to see, very inspiring. I also have to say the generosity, particularly of American funders, was impressive. I had clients who said, look, we gave $10 million away this week, and if we have to do $50 million next week, we'll do that because, you know, whatever it takes, we'll do. Now, that was still somewhat ad hoc, and at some point in time, luckily, things started to change and become a little more paced, a little more thoughtful, or even more thoughtful, I should say. And people took a bit of a step back and looked at their priorities.
So let's say, I think we all went through something chaotic at the beginning, and just a very strong feeling from your kishkas that you had to be in it, and everybody had to be doing something. And you know, I think inevitability that part of that was inefficient. Mm-hmm. And then as you know, the weeks move forward, you're identifying that actually this is going to go on for longer. Ultimately, the army will take care of the requirements of soldiers and so forth, or at least that should be the case. And so philanthropy needs then a different view. What sorts of things were you, what kind of conversations were you having at that point?
Yeah. So listen, I spoke with many, many organizations on the ground, decision makers, read a lot. And my view was, and is still to a large extent, that there are five priorities, you know, beyond the logistic needs, which are still to some extent there, but as you say, taken care of by many other organizations, the army and so on. I saw five priorities. The first one was to support the wave of internal refugees, the displaced communities. Between 150 to 200,000 people who have moved out of the house, might not go back for quite a few months, and need, you know, work, schooling, food, lodging, and so on and so forth. A lot has been done, but there are many, many more needs. And that was for me the first pillar. The second was to help from a trauma and mental health perspective, not just the displaced, but also the survivors, the family of the people who had died on October 7th, and all those who suffer from depression, husbands away for 2 months with wives left with many kids at home, a job to juggle, lots of issues around mental health. The country was not in a great place before October 7th, and so there was even more to do in that space. The third one is about economic resilience and growth. I'm particularly worried about small and medium businesses. Many of them have their leaders or key employees out in the front, and they form the backbone of Israeli economy. And really, there's a risk they would go under. And so I'm particularly looking at no-interest loans as a way of plugging the gap. You know, the government is doing something, and that's very nice, and they acted actually quite fast in that space. But again, there's more to be done. The fourth one is around rebuilding the South. There are communities that were completely destroyed, new communities to build, new infrastructure. This is a bit longer term. The government will hopefully play a bigger role there as well. But there are activities already undergoing that deserve support. And the last thing which I saw as a key priority is what you could call to support an Israeli joint story. The country before October 7 had reached a point of disunity that was at the peak of whatever at least I could remember. We had the other extreme with a sense of achdut, of unity, which is remarkable. And the question is, how do we build on that and ensure that it goes beyond the war? Many fantastic organizations doing great work, and we're looking at how we can strengthen them even further.
So, thinking about those five strategic arenas, I think if you're still now looking in and thinking about what my medium term approach is going to be, there's a lot of if you might call it opportunity, or at least a lot of variation to get into that. And presumably in each one of those five categories, there are going to be many different ways to approach it. So I think that's something which we'll come back to. And to be honest, we could probably dedicate a series of podcasts on those things, and maybe with other people who are involved in those specific arenas. I want to pick up on something which maybe tags to the fifth element of that, which in a certain way, I think what has given some people optimism is the sort of intense and very fast pivot that we've seen with some of the organizations which were so intensely involved with legal reforms and for and against, and then sort of pivoted almost within hours to becoming a very important civic response, and in some cases actually participating very directly in the immediate rescue and the security response. Do you see that being a meaningful dynamic, not just in the sense of, as you call it, you know, about continuing that sense of unity, but does it change the landscape in terms of partnering and, you know, actually dealing with people who previously were, you know, mostly involved in high tech and very little involved in civic society? Are they people who we can now talk about as counterparties for this type of philanthropic effort?
So first of all, absolutely, yes. I think the emergence of a very strong civil society has been an enormous and positive surprise from October 7. I think the combination of the, let's say, the unequal response from the government, which was mostly absent in the first few weeks outside of the Ministry of Defense and maybe of Health, created a massive gap. But the fact that technology enabled people to very quickly assemble groups together, the fact there was an infrastructure of organizations that had been fighting together for or against the justice reform and jumped into the game, that was a massive surprise. And I think some of these organizations will extend their duration beyond the war and be active, which is great. It is unclear today if we can maintain that sense of unity. It is possible that these organizations sort of revert back to their political games and angles. We hope not, and I'm working with funders now who are actually looking to actively encourage them to continue to cooperate and be a positive force for change in the country. But the other very positive surprise has been that the high-tech sector got a lot more involved. Historically, you know, frustration, particularly foreign funders, US funders had with Israel is much of the philanthropic money seems to be coming from abroad. And you have these billions of wealth created in the high-tech sector the philanthropic sector is not getting enough fed by the high tech sector. I actually did a bit of a deep dive on that because it was intriguing to me, and I initially thought I could be helping some of these high tech, billionaires invest their philanthropic money. So when I went to talk to them, I knew them from my work at McKinsey in high tech. I went to talk to them, and I realized that they were in a very different mindset. First of all, they were typically in their 40s or early 50s, and they were thinking of further growth and the need to keep their capital to invest in their next ventures. Second, they were people who 5 years or 10 years ago were poor. They had one car, one and a half car, one apartment. They were just starting to use some of their wealth to buy, you know, a second car, a second apartment, enjoy a nice vacation. And the idea of putting millions of dollars into philanthropy was very foreign to them. You know, in philanthropy, you've got to grow into it. You can't start giving millions. You've got to start giving thousands and then tens of thousands in order to. And they weren't there mentally. But more importantly, they looked at the philanthropic sector as highly ineffective, inefficient, potentially a bit corrupt, and weren't very willing to part away with their hard-earned capital. Now comes the war, and suddenly they see that these philanthropic organizations or these nonprofits helping with the war are run by their colleagues. And so there's immediate trust. they see it's very technology driven, so they understand this world, and suddenly the money has started to flow, and you have these, you have very large donors who jumped in from one day to the next from the high tech community to help with the war response. Also, hopefully, something we can build on going forward.
Yeah, I mean, we've always felt that the cultural view of the, you know, the new money or fast money driven by high tech doesn't really fit the classic models of philanthropy. And yep. As you say, in a sort of classic Israeli mode, often it's considered, you know, that's the government's job or somebody else's job. I pay my taxes, go off and deal with that. I think we're definitely undergoing a change. It will be interesting to see culturally how that sort of very fast, very mission-oriented high-tech guys will mix with the, you know, slow burn of classic philanthropy. But I think hopefully it will bring options. And I think it does, as you mentioned, I think it goes at least some way to helping with the challenge that many in the diaspora have had, which is, well, this is not just our issue. The health and the future of the state of Israel has got to be something which we share, which we're sharing together. So I think, you know, there's lots of things to think about with respect to that. One aspect which I'm really interested to hear about, as you mentioned earlier, in the first few weeks, the general sense was that the government wasn't really getting to grips with much of the civic requirements. And in certain cases, you know, civic society stepped into that. As we roll those things forward, and as your, you know, the philanthropic clients look at the more medium to long term, how are you making assumptions around government planning or government implementation? And is that to be taken into account as you think about those things? Is it something which you'll have to consider as they go forward? Are you saying, well, actually, we should just make plans and ignore? How are you sort of recommending to think about that?
So it's relatively unclear because the response from the government still today is not very transparent. It's also quite unclear what's the duration of this government. There are lots of talks about the government disbanding right after the end of the war and us going to elections again. So my sort of planning horizon is let's not count on the government, except to one area, which is rebuilding the South. I think there I know of plans being put together, infrastructure, rebuilding some yishuvim, setting up new ones. And frankly, the amount at play are large enough that you know, the government is the only player that can make a meaningful difference. But if I look at the refugees, if I look at trauma and mental health, even economic resilience, you know, when you look at the urgency and the magnitude of the issues and the lack of clarity of government plans still today, I think it's better to plan without and to take everything coming from the government as a good surprise. Now, the other sector which is getting to the game big time are the large Israeli companies. And you know, they've set up large funds to help with some of those challenges. I think their social responsibility has been increasing year over year in the last years, and they're now at a stage where they want to make a real difference, right? I think the consumers expect that.
Can you share maybe an example where the corporates are, you know, to get involved with?
When you think of the large banks, for instance, I think Apollo Lim was the first one to set up a large fund for rebuilding communities. When you see how the hotel sector has jumped in to help with internal refugees, when you look at the way that large consumer good companies and supermarkets have been playing a role together with the Leket and the Latet of the world to help distribute food to the needy, you see very inspiring examples of corporate responsibility from the large segments of the economy.
For those who don't watch commercial TV in Israel, one of the things which was extremely obvious was a complete change in sort of advertising messaging, more or less from day one of the war. I've been here 30 years. I've never seen sort of such a swift change from, you know, regular, you know, corporate advertising for all, you know, retail, banking, so on and so forth. Every advert really was about, we are in this together. For those who had, obviously, they would share the things that, you know, the benefits they were giving. We're going to delay interest payments, or, you know, there'll be food for people who have been evacuated. And it was just fascinating to see how, you know, I don't know whether there was kind of communication between the large corporates or the advertising agencies said we have to switch, or they felt just inappropriate to sort of keep the commercial advertising going. But very quickly, every advert finished with, you know, together we will be victorious or something, which was very much related. It's beginning now to softly revert. So I think even the corporate activity is beginning to return to some kind of regular business. But it's just fascinating. I'm sure somebody will end up writing a thesis about it.
So I didn't know that much because I don't watch TV indeed. But one thing I note is that what's often difficult for people abroad to understand is, you know, when the US wages a war, no one knows the soldiers. They're far away socially and geographically. Here in Israel, everybody knows everybody else. Everybody knows the soldiers or people who know the soldiers. It feels much closer. And so you live the war in a way which is much more intimate than whatever else I had known abroad. And as such, of course, large companies feel part of the equation as well, and not as disconnected as they are in some countries.
Yeah, I mean, it, very, very important point. Many of these corporates obviously will have significant numbers of employees themselves called up into reserve duty. You know, we still have complete conscription across the board. So it cuts across all societal, socioeconomic, religious boundaries. So literally, as you say, I mean, there isn't either a neighborhood or a company that isn't in some way affected by this. I want to try and sort of think forward. And there'll be many people watching this who are still considering what the right approach for them may be going forward, and maybe also how they may take their company and take from the company to contribute to this, or as individuals or through the foundations. Maybe as we sort of switch our horizon to 9, 12 months and beyond, what do you think we should be focusing our thoughts on?
So the first thing I would say is every donor, every foundation has their own story. And I think it's very important for them to be giving from a place that recognizes the sort of things they care about, not just from the brain, but also from the heart. What do they intimately care about? And I see that very clearly across my different clients. They each have their areas of interest, of passion, of specificity. And that's great because they bring knowledge and they bring a sense of passion that others don't see. Whether it's women who wanted to learn Torah and were not able to do so and are now willing and are now investing big time into the field, whether there are people concerned about relationship between Jews and Arabs who have always been helping the Arab community integrate better, that invest now in maintaining healthy and positive relationship between Arabs and Jews in Israel, whether it's more activist foundations that feel that the battlefield is not just in Gaza, but it is online. And there's a lot to be done to strengthen Israel's image and invest big time into legal defense and into media relationship, Hasbara and the like. Then we should also recognize that Israel is not the entirety of the challenges of the Jewish people. And I think this war has surfaced a number of challenges that diaspora community have to an extent that I think we were underestimating, and they were probably underestimating, issues of anti-Semitism, issue of physical security of Jewish communities, challenges on university campuses, the need to, through lobbying, ensure that we have friends in the highest levels of government that keep helping us. Or frankly, the fact that, when we think of communication, too much of what we think as communication is talking to our friends online and convincing the convinced of things that we're all convinced about, which ultimately has zero impact. And so there are some who come there and say, well, let me see who I can trigger in my allies, that, non-Jews, evangelical Christians, people of color, people who've seen similar challenges, and how can I activate those allies to replicate my messages and start acting as ambassadors of all the things we have to say. And so all of those are, things that are wonderful in giving when you can actually start from where you really care. The other thing I would say is that one of my big worry is that the war has absorbed so many philanthropic resources that people will forget the nonprofits they were always giving to, some of which are not connected to the war, and some of which need their donors as much as ever. I'm thinking of religious services, you know, Torah learning, of health, poverty. These are issues that are evergreen and the needs are not diminishing, rather the contrary. I'm afraid that when they start knocking on the doors of donors, donors will say, no, I gave everything to the war effort. So I'm encouraging my clients and everybody to look at the war giving as incremental. It was a hopefully once in a lifetime opportunity to go beyond what we typically do and keep next year's giving budgets the same as they were.
Yeah, one of the things which happened, I think during COVID, which was a pleasant surprise, was many foundations understood that they needed to kind of set up a COVID foundation or a COVID fund, but they were very conscious of not negatively impacting the organizations that they were already involved with. I'm hoping that this time, just because of the sums of money involved, it won't negatively impact all those important things which people already supporting. So I think that's a very, very serious thing to think about. And I think everybody who's in the business of giving needs to right. make sure that we're not forgetting those important things that will be needed in any event, in any season. So I think that's super important.
Yeah.
I think that we have touched on a number of issues that we could probably do a series of podcasts together. And your usual insight has brought, you know, so many things to the attention of people who are going to watch this and see it. It's been really fantastic to have you on. I look forward also to doing this again, and maybe we'll see how things have developed for philanthropy maybe in another few months. And I think the crucial message for everybody is, think about where you're giving your dollars or shekels. Assume that there is somebody out there with whom you can do more together with them than separately. If you think and use some of those business skills, which Michael brings obviously to Israel Impact, then you know you actually may be able to do more with the same amount than you previously thought. And sometimes actually you can do vastly more even with less just by thinking about it in a more strategic fashion. So I hope that you've had a taste of that with Michael today. And I just want to say thank you, Michael, for joining us.
A pleasure. It was great, Daniel, to see you again as always.